The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tastytrade Inc. is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
It certainly is, Judge. Thanks so much. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Wilfred Frost. Here's what's ahead on the show. More hawkish Fed speak to end the shortened trading week, and the market seems okay with it. Is it out of ignorance or indifference? Because there's plenty that is going right to keep the rally going. Plus, we'll head around the world once again for three buys and a bail Europe edition. Sadly, the UK stock's being dumped. Our trader has three names she likes and one she's steering clear of. And the AI underdogs at the verge of an opportunity our analyst says he hasn't seen in a decade. He brings the names to watch. That's all ahead, but we begin with today's markets. Dom Chu has the numbers for us. Dom.
Hey, Wilfred, a modest close to the third quarter on pace right now, but still it could be the best fourth quarter, rather, that the markets have seen in the S&P 500 since 2019. So as we talk about the moves that we're seeing, we're just a stone's throw away from record highs for all three of the major indices, some of which have actually hit record highs themselves just during the course of this trading week. The Dow Industrial is up about 11 points, just about flat on the session, 39,771. 5250 is the current S&P 500 level, up 2 points. Again, modest gains up there. And just by the way, we were up about 8 points at the highs and down 3 at the lows. So it's been a very tight trading range for the S&P 500. The NASDAQ Composite at 16,377, down 21 points or 0.1%. So again, very steady moves to try to close out this first quarter that could be a pretty big one for the S&P overall. Now, for that first quarter, year-to-date basis, you take a look at the real storylines developing. Large caps versus small caps. We've seen a rising tide for everything, but look, the large cap S&P 500 is still handily outperforming the small cap Russell 2000 by about a twofold difference here. And of course, the stock that's driving a lot of that is Nvidia, up 82% in just, again, the first quarter of this year-to-date so far. Now, is it growth or is it value? The large cap outperformance tells you that it's still about growth right now. But yes, we can kind of put some numbers to it as well. If you take a look at the large cap growth ETF that tracks the Russell 1000 versus the value ETF that tracks the Russell 1000 value index, you'll start to see something developing there as well. If we'll show you that, if not, then we'll just not show that as well. But then we'll kind of cap things off with what's happening with Estee Lauder. Estee Lauder, the stock of the day, pretty much handily outperforming every other stock in the S&P 500. Analysts at Bank of America have upgraded this stock to a buy from neutral. The target price goes to $170 from $160. They think that the earnings trends are starting to bottom out for Estee Lauder, the big name behind brands like its namesake, also La Mer, Clinique, and others. They also look at this stock and say, hey, maybe there's some value to be had there, up 6% right now. Far and away, the best performer, Wolf, in the S&P 500 today. I'll send things back over to you.
Dom Chu, great stuff. Thanks so much for that. The Dow, S&P, both essentially flatlining as we stand. The Nasdaq just negative now. Well, we'll begin with the story of the day. FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried sentenced to 25 years in prison for massive crypto fraud. Kate Rooney's outside of the courthouse in Manhattan with more for us. Kate, 25 years was the number.
That's right, Wolf. Yeah, Sam Bankman-Fried, the former CEO of FTX, really seen at one point as the legitimate face of the cryptocurrency industry, is now sentenced to 25 years in prison. This caps off what prosecutors call one of the largest financial frauds in U.S. history. The judge today ordered Bankman-Fried to forfeit over $11 billion. They're recommending a jail in the San Francisco Bay Area so his family, which is based there, can visit with Mark McKasey. The defense team, key lawyer, said there will be an appeal. We also have a statement from Bankman-Fried's family saying we are heartbroken and will continue to fight for our son. The judge today talked about the enormous harm Bankman-Fried did, the brazenness of his actions, as they put it, and his exceptional flexibility with the truth and an apparent lack of any real remorse, Wolf, which was, we got some of the reasoning behind the sentencing, and that was one of the key parts. Perjury and his lack of remorse played into the sentencing, Wolf.
What was the emotion, Kate? I know you were in the courtroom at times, you were outside as people were leaving. What was the emotion from his parents?
From his parents, I was face to face with his parents as they walked out here, Wolf. We were asking for a comment. They said, you know, can you please respect our space and our time here? They did kind of pause for a moment, though, and face the cameras. His mother almost looked like a ghost. She looked just completely stoic and just honestly devastated. The parents throughout this entire criminal trial in the courtroom were bent over at times. She was seen crying multiple times throughout this. So a really emotional day for the family. You know, their comment suggests they're still going to continue to support him. We have not seen his brother, Gabe, who was part of the campaign finance conversation, and he was running a lot of what was going on in D.C., but it was, yeah, shocking to be face-to-face with the parents after what's been more than a year and a half of this.
Okay, Rooney, as always, thanks so much for that. Let's get more context around the sentencing and bring in Danny Sevelos. He's a legal analyst for NBC News and MSNBC, as well as the co-founder of the law firm Sevelos and Wong. Danny, thanks so much for joining us. Great to see you. Your initial reaction, 25 years?
It's interesting because under the U.S. sentencing guidelines, as calculated, Sam Bankman-Fried's sentence range would have been so high, it was technically an illegal sentence. It was actually in excess of the statutory maximums. That's how high his expected sentence, as calculated under the guidelines, would have been. Bankman-Fried's attorneys challenged that by essentially arguing, hey, there was no loss, because loss to the victims is the largest driver of these kinds of white-collar crimes. And so the judge rejected that, but yet, even though the judge rejected the defense's loss argument, the judge still went way below what the government was requesting, 40 to 50 years, and only 25 years, which represents a substantial departure. And here's the crazy thing about the U.S. sentencing guidelines, is that ever since the Supreme Court decision a couple decades ago, they're not even mandatory. As long as a judge calculates them, the judge can go below the sentencing guidelines. So judges have considerable discretion in this area. And this has been a very controversial area of sentencing, because the guidelines take a nonviolent, non-gun, non-drug offender, and because of the loss amount, which admittedly here is so much that it's beyond the highest level of the guidelines, which only goes up to $550 million. So in a case like this, the judge, in the judge's discretion, decided to go somewhere in the middle of what the government was asking.
I mean, at the same time, the judge was criticizing Bankman-Fried for perjuring himself, for not engaging sufficiently and taking things seriously, which could have led to a sentence at the higher end of the scale. So why has he settled for a relatively low number at 25? Is it because of this fact that crypto's rebounded, that the people that lost money initially might get some or all of it back, things like that?
That's probably a major factor. It's an argument that the defense made, is that the loss here, because remember, the government and the probation department kind of arrive at their own number for loss. And so loss can mean a lot of different things. Is it the amount that actually went into SBF's pocket? Is it the amount that disappeared? And if it is the amount that disappeared, then should he get credit for the money that some people are able to get back, especially if they get dollar for dollar, 100 cents on the dollar? So loss is never a concrete number, at least in one defense attorney's mind. That's me. And in fact, the law has changed considerably in the last couple of years. It used to be intended loss. Now it's really supposed to be actual loss. What is the actual loss? So the judge may have taken that into consideration. But either way, the sentence that he gave was far below what the recommended sentencing guidelines were. The judge has the discretion to do that. But it's very interesting, because when a judge excoriates a defendant for the bad things he did during sentencing, as a defense attorney, you're thinking, uh-oh, that means we're going to be on the high end of the range. And Sam Bankman-Fried was definitely not on the high end of the range. I know 25 years is a lot of time, but what he could have gotten was quite a bit more.
When you look through the entire case, the entire trial, the evidence that the prosecution provided to get to this conviction, was it very clear to authorities, had we not seen crypto prices crash? I guess I'm asking the extent to which, flipping on its head, he might have got away with all of this if we'd seen Bitcoin prices hold up throughout like they have now and bounced again.
That's possible. I mean, look, this is just my take as a defense attorney, but, you know, federal prosecutors are prosecutors. They're selective prosecutors. They have limited resources. So do they sometimes get their ideas from watching the news of who to maybe investigate? Yeah, that's possible. But the reality is that, you know, once you get the attention of federal investigators, nothing good can come of that, whether that attention comes from media, whether it comes from your company making an ill-advised stock move or business decision. No matter what, once federal investigators are on to you, bad things are probably going to happen. And that's exactly, this was a prosecution 101 government prosecution in a financial crime. They got to his cohorts, his co-defendants, got them to turn on Bankman-Fried. And from there, it was really smooth sailing for the government all the way. Arguably, the only reason Bankman-Fried testified was either one of two reasons. Either he insisted on it as a client, or the defense team thought, it's so hopeless, we might as well put him up there and just try it out.
Danny Savalos, thanks so much for joining us. Much appreciated. Right, turning back to the markets, a key piece of economic data on deck tomorrow, core PCE, the Fed's preferred gauge of inflation. Well, in a speech at the Economic Club of New York yesterday, Fed Governor Christopher Waller said there's a case to be made for holding off on cutting rates.
I see economic output and the labor market showing continued strength while progress in reducing inflation has slowed. Because of these signs, I see no rush in taking the step of beginning to ease monetary policy.
Well, my next guest says he expects one of the sticking points for the Fed, wage inflation, to ease in the months ahead. Joining me now, David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management. David, great to see you. Thanks for joining me. Before we get to the wage inflation point, what did you make of Waller's comments earlier this week? We were talking to James Gorman. He said he wouldn't be surprised if there was no rate cuts at all. Your expectation of the number of cuts and what would happen to markets if we did indeed get none?
I think we probably will get three cuts. The Fed is clearly on the tight side of neutral right now. The economy is gradually slowing down. And what the economy has proven over the last year is we can have good growth even as inflation comes down. But I think the most important thing to recognize here, which I feel the Federal Reserve has not recognized properly, is that they have really distorted financial markets for many years by keeping rates much too low and then much too high. So I don't think about a neutral federal funds rate in terms of the economy. The economy is actually pretty good at looking after itself. What I look for is a neutral rate for financial markets, and they really need to move back towards that neutral rate. So long as the economy is doing okay, so long as inflation is gradually coming down, I think that they should and will cut in June.
Well, presumably you don't think at the moment that the rates are too tight for financial markets. We're at record highs. Gold just hit one as well.
Yes, but that's sort of a relic of a lot of the liquidity that's been put into markets in recent years. So, you know, we're clearly continuing quantitative tightening, trying to mop up some of that liquidity. But in general, we've there's been a disconnect between economic performance, earnings performance, and markets. We've got a lot of inequality in the country, which is pouring money into financial assets rather than fueling real investment. So I can sort of see some of the reasons that we've got this very boomy stock market here. But nevertheless, I think the Federal Reserve ought to gradually move back towards a normal level of the federal funds rate.
And one factor you think that will allow them to do that is wage inflation.
Well, yes, because what's going on is it's amazing that we don't have more wage inflation here. We've had a tight labor market that everybody's known about for the last 2 to 3 years. We've still got 9 million job openings in this country, which is well above anything we saw before the pandemic. And yet wage growth is down to about 4.3% year over year. And what I'm seeing is only 6% of the private sector is in a union. There have been zero major strikes so far this year. We're seeing a lot of immigration coming into the country and filling low wage jobs in places like retail and home care and so forth, in daycare. And so I think what you're going to see is pressure from low wage workers holding down wage growth. We're not really seeing that translate into higher consumer inflation. So I think we're still on pace for consumer inflation to come down here, and the Federal Reserve should stop trying to micromanage the economy.
So give me the flip side. What if James Gorman was right or Mr. Waller was right and we didn't get any cuts at all? Would that destabilize the equity market?
It could, because what's going to happen is, you know, the equity market never stops at the limits of prudence. It stops at the limits of exuberance. And unfortunately, what it'll tend to do is it keeps on grinding higher until it is demonstrably very high. We're already at 21 times forward earnings, which is rich. And particularly some of the biggest stocks are extremely expensive here. But it could keep going. And the higher it goes, before some shock occurs, the greater will be the decline when that shock does occur. So I do worry about that down the road. I think people need to be diversified here, but I don't think the Federal Reserve should really try and micromanage that either. I don't think they're capable of doing it.
Let's talk about some regions where things are a bit cheaper, and Europe is one of them. Is it cheap for a reason, or in fact, relatively attractive at the moment?
There are reasons for Europe to be cheaper than the US. The US has got a much bigger technology sector in its stock market. Europe tends to be more about financials and healthcare, and in the case of the UK, commodities. But still, even if you account for that, even if you look sector by sector across the 10 big sectors in the S&P, in every single sector, Europe is cheaper than the US in the same sector. So right now, US stocks are selling at a 21 times forward PE. European stocks are selling at a 14 times PE. So it's you get one third off buying European stocks, and they've got twice the dividend yield of US stocks. And, this has been a great quarter and another, after a very good year for the U.S. market. But people are very overweight U.S. equities in global portfolios. And I think it makes sense to diversify a bit because, again, sooner or later, some shock will hit the market. You'll get a big tumble. The things that tumble the most are the things that are most highly priced to start with. And that's where I think the risk in the U.S. is.
That said, the pullbacks in both 22 and 23 did see Europe pull back kind of alongside the US, so nowhere was safe, I think, in that regard. But David, we're out of time there. Thanks so much, David Kelly from JP Morgan Asset Management. By the way, don't miss our special coverage of tomorrow morning's key PCE data. We'll have the number and the news along with analysis and reaction streaming on CNBC.com starting 8:15 a.m. Eastern Time. So to come here on The Exchange, the investigation and recovery efforts at the Port of Baltimore are ongoing in the wake of this week's key bridge collapse. Up next, we'll speak with the heads of the Virginia and New York, New Jersey ports about how they're planning to handle the influx of extra ships and cargo. Plus, we're wrapping up our Around the World series with three buys and a bail in Europe. We teed it up there. A little bit of big picture perspective from David Kelly. We're going to go into the individual stock names a little bit later. This name rallied 70% to start the year, and our trader says it's time to get out. You might be able to guess which one that is. Certainly, if you're in the UK, you would. It's the one tech success story of the last decade in the UK. We'll discuss later.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange. It's been 2 days since the fatal collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Maryland. And with the Port of Baltimore closed, for now, shipments are being diverted along the East Coast, mainly to Virginia and New York. And joining me now to discuss the impact is Stephen Edwards. He's the Port of Virginia CEO. And Rick Cotton, who's Executive Director of the New York and New Jersey Port Authority. Gentlemen, great to have you both on. Of course, very sad circumstances as to the trigger for these bookings. Stephen, I'll come to you first of all. Have you seen immediate pickup in traffic to your port as a result of this issue? Are you expecting it?
Yeah, so first let me also say it's a terrible tragedy. I mean, none of us want this to happen to any port. And so from all of us here, we know the Port of Baltimore well, and we're thinking of them, and we think of the families with the lost folk here. Coming to the cargo, yes, but we break the sectors down, start with the container sector, which is really the familiar one for consumers. We are seeing cargo started to discharge here as early as Tuesday. But I think the key point here is that 9 of the 10 services that go to the Port of Baltimore on a weekly basis call here. And of all 10, they call between New York, Virginia, and Philadelphia. So it's not extra port calls per ships, but it's more cargo coming on and off those ships. So we're in good shape. We're in great shape to handle that cargo. Ocean carriers who are diverting that cargo to us are communicating exceptionally well on what their plans are. Our capacity is available, I think, between New York and ourselves, or Virginia, New York, and Philadelphia. On the container sector, we will be seeing a relatively smooth operation. The cargo will have to be moved by the motor carriers, and we're seeing motor carriers from Baltimore already registered with us. Over 60 have registered to come in and out of our port. And I believe the same will be happening in other ports. So I do believe in that sector, we're going to be in very, very good shape. The roll-on, roll-off sector, which is the import of cars or the movement of tractors and machinery, that's where Baltimore is the number one port. They have a great market share in that area. And that's going to be more challenging for certain ports, ourselves included. But we are going to see our first ship on Friday discharge tractors and machinery into this port. And I believe in the car sector, we're going to see cargo from Rhode Island through New York, Wilmington, Delaware, and ourselves as that roll-on, roll-off sector gets spread a little wider. But I really do expect the container sector to move quite smoothly.
Rick, is it your take something similar in New York and New Jersey, that it's like not a big pickup in ships, but more containers coming off?
That's exactly what it is. I also want to start by saying that this was obviously a tragedy in Baltimore, and our hearts and thoughts are with the families of those who perished. That's exactly what we expect to see. We don't expect to see additional ships. What we expect to see is additional cargo coming off of those ships. Right now, even though the volumes here are resilient, at the height of COVID, we handled 20% more volume than we're handling right now. So we have the capacity to offload cargo that may have been intended to go directly to the Port of Baltimore. We have the capacity through making arrangements with truckers who might come up from Baltimore, but also we understand that CSX and Norfolk Southern are in the process of scheduling additional trains that would be able to transfer cargo that was intended for Baltimore that we offload here.
So, I mean, you're both making it sound very smooth for your respective ports, which I guess is a good thing. Rick, I mean, what level of preparation have you had to do for it to be, hopefully be as smooth as you're saying? Do you have to get more staff in, more hours, more equipment, or is there always this excess capacity?
Well, in the Port of New York in New Jersey is the second busiest in the nation. So, and there are monthly fluctuations, and we're able to adjust. Our marine terminals have, as I said, extra capacity. They surged it during COVID. They can surge it now. It may require additional gate hours depending upon whether the cargo is departing here by truck or by train, but we are prepared to surge as necessary to handle the cargo. The car volume will be a little more challenging because the cars need to be driven off of the ships. But if the railroads step in and provide additional capacity on car trains, we're registering truckers who are registered in Baltimore. If they want to come pick up their containers here, we're certainly open to that.
Stephen, what was the reaction? I guess not just your personal reaction, but everyone that works in and around the Virginia port to the collision initially, and the worry that something similar could happen near you.
Well, I think the initial reaction was clearly shock, and our emergency response team were notified early of the incident. And I don't think we've seen a collision like it, not in my lifetime of working in the industry. But I think when it comes to our port, we're fortunate. We don't have bridges in the Port of Virginia. We are all tunnels. And the way tunnels work is that the channel itself goes across the tunnel at a safe point. And if a ship were to divert from the channel, then it will run aground before it would hit a structure. So we don't face the risk that other ports face of bridges and bridge reinforcements in the harbor. So we are fortunate in that. It has other benefits because we have no air draft limitations when it comes to ships coming in and out of the harbor. I would reiterate also just what Rick said. We've handled, as an industry, natural disasters before. So when you think about the readiness of the East Coast, we've had Superstorm Sandy in the past. We have hurricane preparedness to the south. And I think as an industry, we're quite used to surges. And some of those surges you will see in the normal course of business. That surge can be a nor'easter taking a port out for 3 days because of snow. It can be closing for a hurricane for 2 days. It can be, by example, Superstorm Sandy. And therefore, I think in the East Coast, what you have is all the players know each other. So from Virginia through New York, Baltimore, Philadelphia, we all know each other. And therefore, we can all work collaboratively quite well. I think the other response we've seen to this, which is great in our overall community, is both the Coast Guard and Customs and Border Protection. They're stepping forward if we need to bring on surge capacity. So if we're required to bring on more of our buffer capacity, we'll bring it online and we'll do it very quickly.
Stephen and Rick, we're going to have to leave it there, but we really appreciate the time. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion, and our next guest has several containers on the crashed cargo ship and is managing shipping diversions for many others. He says the economic impact of the Key Bridge collapse could total $4 billion. Well, Alan Baer joins us now. He's the president and CEO of shipping logistics company OLUSA. Thanks so much for joining us, Alan. So just give us that context. You have some clients' containers on the ship itself.
We do. And let me just first echo the previous speakers and our condolences and thoughts go out to the families of those involved in this tragedy, as they said. We have several, just to jump onto the logistics side, we have several customers who have cargo on board the ship. We're waiting for more news on that. We have a lot of cargo actually en route into Baltimore. We ship in and out of Baltimore every week. We have cargo sitting on the piers waiting for other vessels that should have come in but won't now. So we're arranging to pick that up and move it to some of the ports that will be used, Norfolk, Virginia, New York, Philadelphia, to make sure we get the supply chains up and running as quickly as possible.
How many alternatives are there? And is it we seeing an immediate adjustment in prices for this sort of shipping product? Or because there are quite a few alternatives, is it not led to too much of an increase in costs?
I think basically from an ocean freight standpoint, not too much of a change in cost. You really will see that if you're a Baltimore local importer or exporter, and you now need to arrange to pick up your cargo in New York or Norfolk, for example, or Philly, you'll have an increased inland freight. For the folks, let's say, in the Ohio Valley, Midwest, they have a number of alternatives. Again, they can rail it into Norfolk. They can rail it into New York. We also see cargo via the Canadian Gateway. They'll go up through Montreal and out to Halifax as well and load ships there. So in that sense, I don't know that we'll see an increase in ocean costs, more domestic freight for those in and around Baltimore.
So when we say in the intro that you think the overall cost, I guess, to the economy could be $4 or $5 billion, what are we talking about there? How do you get to that number? And all things considered, are you suggesting it's actually not that big a number? Things could have been quite a lot worse.
Well, you're looking there at an insurance estimate. So between the ships, the damages, replacement of infrastructure, and things like that, that was a estimate provided by a couple of folks who follow the insurance industry. They had looked at estimates to replace the bridge and then ship costs, cargo relocation, business interruption. That was the total that they were coming up with at that point.
And then just finally, what about those containers on board? When's your expectation that you might be able to get those off and when the ship might finally come to shore?
Well, yeah, that's the tricky thing, because as everybody's commented in and around Baltimore, for sure, everybody's anxious to get the port back up and running. And there's somewhat of a snowball effect because right now you can't book any cargo in or out of Baltimore. And that starts to feed on itself because you have ships with 30, 40 day transits. And so you're loading already now for Norfolk and New York. When you look at the pictures, there are some containers that are somewhat dangling or pinned to the ship. So that'll be an engineering feat to pick that up, secure the containers, make sure what you can not allow to fall into the water, which could further exacerbate the issues. And then eventually, our estimate is they have to return the ship to a berth and take that cargo off while they assess the damage that the bow of the ship might have incurred. I know the Army Corps of Engineers is on site, and we're all anxiously awaiting their estimate of all of exactly those things. When can they move the ship? When can they create an opening in the channel and allow maritime traffic to resume?
Alan Bear, thanks so much for joining us. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Still ahead here on The Exchange, there's an under-the-radar underdog story playing out on Wall Street. And one firm says there's an overlooked group of stocks that will be major beneficiaries from the generative AI boom. We'll reveal the names and opportunities ahead. We're back after a couple of minutes.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Good afternoon and welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson with your CNBC update this hour. President Biden's campaign will hold a star-studded campaign fundraiser today at Radio City Music Hall in New York. Stay out of that neighborhood. That will include two of his predecessors, President Obama and Clinton, as Democrats set their sights on the general election later this year. The fundraiser, slated to bring in more than $25 million, will work to boost Biden's reelection campaign as he faces concerns about his age and other things. New Jersey Representative Mikey Sherrill says she will introduce a bill tomorrow that would keep any federal officials from accessing classified information. The GUARD Act not only targets Senator Bob Menendez, who faces 18 federal counts, but also former President Donald Trump, who will soon start to receive intelligence briefings, as is customary for presidential nominees. And Pope Francis appeared to look strong as he urged priests to treat their worshipers with mercy during Holy Thursday Mass at the Vatican. His appearance comes after a string of health issues over the past winter and a busy weekend ahead with, of course, the Easter holidays. Wolf, back to you. It's been great having you here this week.
It's been my pleasure, Tyler. Thanks so much for the welcome.
Thank you.
So to come, here's one more look at our mystery chart that our trader says is too rich for her blood at 84 times earnings. We'll reveal the name in the next three buys and a bail. We're back after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. Well, from China to Japan to India, we've gone around the world this week in search of emerging opportunities, foreign opportunities. Our trip comes to an end today in the motherland. It's time for three buys and a bail, Europe edition. We'll hear with the trades today. Gina Sanchez, Lido Advisors chief market strategist and a CNBC contributor. Gina, great to see you. Long time no speak. Great that you're picking out some stocks back in Europe for us. First one, you've gone with Roche, which is, of course, the Swiss pharma company. It's off about 6% so far this year. Modest guidance for the year ahead. Bank of America saying it's one of the most well-held large stocks in Europe. Why do you like it here?
So finally, the sort of COVID comps are starting to kind of become a thing of the past. And so we're starting to sort of go into some more positive outlook for the company. And as they're continuing to grow revenues, also their margins are also expanding. And so they're really setting up to do well. You know, they're being cautious, but I do think that this is a company that continues to deliver. We'll see how the lung cancer data comes out in terms of their pipeline. But on the whole, this is a company that is doing everything right and finally getting past that those COVID comps.
OK, next up, we've gone for Total Energies, the French energy company. It's up 7% so far this month. Morgan Stanley and Bank of America named it a top pick in the oil space earlier in the year, and the stock hasn't got a single sell rating at the moment, which might be a worry. But you still like this one, Gina. I mean, talk us about the valuation as well, because I always think when you see valuation discounts, Europe versus the US, you can kind of explain them at times. But on energy companies, the companies really are very similar. It's not like tech, where US tech is just a lot better.
Without a doubt. But if you look at what they're doing for the future, they're really fully embracing LNG, and they have been making moves and have been diversifying their energy portfolio. So, you know, it will take years. This is an energy company. This isn't the sort of thing that you can really turn around on a dime. But they are doing all of the things that you need to create a better energy and more diversified energy portfolio for the future. So that long run story is probably what's propelling this story, and it will take time for that to work out. But they're still a solid energy player. And I agree with you, there's very little difference right now. But small moves now could actually mean very large moves in 5 or 10 years' time.
And like Roche, both have good dividend yields. Let's go on to the next one. Another buy from you, Anheuser-Busch InBev, ABI, also known as Bud, in the U.S. listing. And they're up 13%, the U.S. shares, since the company announced a $1 billion share buyback program last fall. The stock's pretty popular with the streets. Got 13 buys, not a single sell rating, according to FactSet. Gina, we've seen the industry as a whole, though. Diageo, for example, come out with some profit warnings of late. So talk us through why you like this one.
Well, so this one actually has a tremendous moat. This is a company that had a massive social media boycott and still managed to grow revenues. And that's saying something. And right now, most people who are looking at Europe right now are looking for great companies that are cheaper than the U.S. because the outlook for Europe is still a bit sluggish. And this is a cheap company with a great moat that shows that they can survive just about anything, because that was a pretty big hit. I think for sort of total value, there's a lot of unlocked value here.
And now we're going to go for the one where you think we should be sellers, a bail, and that's Arm, which was our mystery chart that we were talking about earlier. Shares are up 70% so far this year. Mizuho recently raised its price target on the stock by 60%. Dollars, citing an attractive long-term roadmap ahead. I mean, Arm obviously is a great innovator. It's got exposure to the AI theme, which is why it's taken off this year. But quite a few pointing to that all of a sudden jump in the chart, which we just showed, as being something that's kind of unsustainable.
You're absolutely right. This is a great little stock. So it's not that I don't like the company. I think what they do is great. They make, you know, less powerful chips, but they're very power efficient. And so, you know, they're great in smartphones. They're great. They're moving into electric cars. And so there's a good story there. But 84 times earnings, I don't care how great you think the outlook is. There's no way. They're not a huge, powerful chip maker. They're going into a lot of smaller, smaller stories and expanding at the margins. So how they're going to get over an 84 times earning, 84 times multiple, is going to be a real challenge.
Arm Holdings from Cambridge, England. It's a sell, according to Gina Sanchez. Gina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, forget NVIDIA. There's some less well-known names that could be at the verge of major transformation due to AI, the analyst behind that statement joins us with the names and why he's so bullish. That's next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Here, look at markets right now. We're up, but only slightly, just a handful of basis points for both the Dow and the S&P, down a handful of basis points for the Nasdaq. The Russell is the leader today. The small cap index is up about 0.5%. We are on track for the best first quarter in 5 years for the S&P 500. It's the outperformer, narrowly beating the NASDAQ, as you can see, for the quarter as a whole. S&P 500 up 10%, NASDAQ up 9%. The Dow and the Russell lagging a little bit, up about 5% or so. But nonetheless, it's been a very nice, strong first quarter for U.S. markets. Well, still to come, there's one group of stocks that my next guest says stand to gain big from AI, but they may not be on your radar just yet. He'll make his case. That's up next. Welcome back. Well, generative AI has been a clear tailwind for some of the well-known big tech names like Nvidia, of course. Our next guest sees potential for the technology in a different, less talked about group of stocks, and that's web tool platform names. He's initiating Yelp on his AI underdog thesis, resuming coverage on several other names, including GoDaddy, which is his top pick. Let's bring in Raymond James analyst Josh Beck, along with our own Deirdre Bosa, for today's Tech Check. A very good afternoon to you both. So just talk us through, first of all, Josh, what we're talking about here in terms of these web tool names. Why is AI a strong factor for them too?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on the show. You know, when you peel back the web building space, I think the knee jerk reaction from investors was, well, with these new tools, it's easy to create images, it's easy to create text. So the next line of thought was, well, it must be easy to replicate a web presence, and we don't think that's the case. We actually think these web builder tools, particularly GoDaddy, are really well positioned to embed these Gen AI tools into their own web stack and actually make it a lot easier for small businesses to create a web presence. You know, I think the what gets lost a little bit in the fray is it's pretty complex to host a website. There's security aspects to it. There's just regular kind of cloud hosting. There's inventory management. There's payments. There's a lot that goes into that. And I actually think it's easier for these web development platforms to embed AI versus the opposite. And that's why we're constructive on the group, and we see upside to about $150 at GoDaddy.
So Dee, talk us through what the view is in Silicon Valley as to whether these web tool names are actually threatened by AI or not.
I think there's a very, very different view here in Silicon Valley. Just for instance, you have a new generation of kids who are going to be using this tool in the future to build websites. They're going to go to the ChatGPT store. They're going to go to a generative AI native company, i.e. built in this era, like a Builder AI or one of many others, versus a GoDaddy that was, again, built in a different era, that's more of an internet company than it is a generative AI company. So, Josh, I just wonder how you think that rolls out. Maybe there's a brief period where they're able to, you know, pull in APIs and allow for this sort of low-code, no-code AI wrapper for some websites. But how is that sustainable?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think this is a very common battle line in Silicon Valley right now. Obviously, if you look at the foundational model space, right, you have the incumbents, Google, Microsoft, right? You have labs, you have startups. They're kind of all littered in the space. But I think one of the learnings from the foundational model layer is there are real advantages to scale. And if you own the data about these customers and you can incorporate some of the tools, there's a large advantage. The other point that I think is probably more important for the web builder market is it has a little bit of a consumer element to it, like you said. But, you know, these companies really lean into that. They spend about $1 billion annually on marketing so that when you go and you say, hey, I want to create a website, GoDaddy or one of these other platform surfaces. And so you kind of, they're in some ways the gatekeeper, I would say, if you want a web presence. You have to have a domain. They're the largest domain registrant. And what they're doing is just making it very easy from, okay, you have a website idea. Here's a logo. Let us use generative AI. A typical logo design process could be weeks. It costs a few hundred dollars. In this case, it's going to be a fraction of that. in terms of cost and time. And then they're going to say, okay, we'll take this logo and build you a website. What do you think? Would you like to make the tone more playful? Do you want to make it more serious? So I really think it's a good point. There's going to be a lot of new tools competing for this space, but I think owning the domain makes it very strategic for them.
And Dee, if someone was wanting to build a new website, but in the new era of coding and AI, and you listed all the clever names that I don't understand, but would you be going to the ChatGPTs, the Microsoft AI tools, the Google AI tools, or are there smaller startups and companies that are kind of focusing specifically on website building?
Yeah, there's certainly smaller startups that are up and coming. I mentioned one, which is Builder AI, that says, you know, making a website, making an app right now is as easy as ordering a pizza. Still, it's not like mainstream, but it's hard to imagine a world in which you don't have a generation of AI companies that are native AI make this shift versus sort of some of the legacy names, just like what we saw in the mobile era, right? It led to the rise of brand new companies like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb that were able to build for a mobile era. And, you know, a lot of folks here in Silicon Valley say that you need to be in it and start from scratch with that kind of experience and that those kind of employees in order to be successful when you're seeing a platform shift this big.
Dee, Josh Beck, thanks both so much for joining us. Much appreciated. As we leave you here on The Exchange, we are just negative on the NASDAQ, just positive on the Dow. The S&P, of course, has been a very strong month, a very strong quarter so far. The S&P set to close the quarter up more than 10%. It's been a real pleasure being here this week on The Exchange. Power Lunch, up next.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.